From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, pro-Russian demonstrators defying Ukraine's ultimatum, fighting displacing thousands in the CAR. Man to face hate crime charges in a U.S. shooting, plus a report urging quicker action to avoid climate disaster. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Pro-Russian protesters in eastern Ukraine stormed another police station on Monday as they continued to defy a government deadline to vacate occupied buildings in exchange for amnesty. Ukraine's president has called for UN peacekeepers to help in an anti-terror operation against the separatists. Henry Ridgewell reporting now from the regional capital Donetsk in eastern Ukraine.
Monday was meant to signal the start of the Kiev government's military assault. Instead, the pro-Russian protesters gained more ground, smashing their way into the police headquarters in the city of Khorlivka near Donetsk. One Western journalist was attacked, the latest in a series of incidents involving foreign media. Later, the pro-Russian gunmen declared that the police had switched sides. An unnamed gunman announced that all the heads of regional administrations in the east have switched to the side of the people and refused to recognize the government in Kiev. In Slovyansk, heavily armed gunmen seized a nearby airfield, which they claim had been used by government forces Sunday. The head of the self-proclaimed Slovyansk Self-Defense Force, Vyacheslav Ponomarev, appealed to Moscow for help. Respected President of the Russian Federation, he said, we urge you to personally pay attention to the current situation and help us as your powers and possibilities permit. Western governments say Russia already is behind the protests. Military observers say the protesters' modern weaponry is identical to that used by the Russian military. Moscow denies involvement. In Kiev, frustrated Ukrainians took to the streets to demand the government take action against separatists in the east. Acting President Alexander Turchynov questioned police loyalty. Today, they are demonstrating an inability to defend citizens, he said, and actively withstanding the terrorism and separatist movement. However, the president held out the possibility of holding a referendum on Ukraine's future. That apparent concession emboldened protesters in the eastern city of Donetsk. On stage, speakers demanded a referendum, while some in the crowd answered with chants of Russia. But within the protest movement, there are disagreements. Local resident Dima welcomed the possibility of a referendum. I want the referendum, he said. Everyone should be asked how they want to live. Personally, I want to live in Russia. Another Donetsk resident, Anatoly Bitovich, disagreed. I would vote to stay in Ukraine, he said. I want to live in Ukraine, but to be separated from the center and the west. Talk of a referendum may help to de-escalate the situation. But as protesters occupy more state buildings, the authority of the Kiev government in eastern Ukraine appears to be weakening by the day. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Donetsk.
And now to Moscow, where Michael Eccles reports on a huge weekend rally.
The air was alternately sad, angry, and jubilant as activists turned out to rally for truth. In a concert-like setting, activists condemned the shutdown of Russian independent media outlets and decried their Kremlin-linked colleagues, whom they hold directly responsible for manipulating the population into supporting what they consider to be contemptible military action in Ukraine. Muscovite Yekaterina, dressed in Ukrainian attire, recently returned from Kyiv's Maidan Square. She had strong words about the mainstream press in Russia.
We're against the sellout media outlets trying to zombify the nation through lies.
About 5,000 people attended the rally. Among the speakers was Andrei Zubov, a history professor fired for his dissenting opinion on Ukraine. Zubov lambasted the bloodshed in the eastern Ukraine cities of Slavyansk and Mariupol, where dozens are reported hurt.
Если вы видите, что войну называют миром,
When you see war being called peace and occupying forces being called peaceful citizens, know that you are being led off a cliff.
Zubov warned against believing the Russian press's version of events. In Kyiv, Ukraine's acting president Alexander Turchynov has announced military action, and Interfax reports a battalion of 350 troops mobilized to the region. Back in Moscow, Bella, whose father is a Ukrainian from Donetsk, was worried about what would happen to her relatives there.
I do not want my father's hometown to turn into radioactive dust, as Mr. Kozlov threatens. I could not sit at home.
Russian media pundit and Kremlin loyalist Dmitry Kiselyov was one of the rallygoers' targets for his propagandic views. In addition to misinformation, System Administrator Yevgeny, who calls himself an anarchist, said a lack of information is another problem.
We do not like this trend of repressive laws the government's using to block media and internet resources it does not like.
As the situation becomes convoluted and murky, Muscovites, Russians, Ukrainians, and the rest of the world wait for any information that could prevent the war that appears to be coming. Michael Eccles for VOA News, Moscow.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
An apparent car bombing, that is, at a Nigerian bus station has killed at least 71 and injured more than 120 others. President Goodluck Jonathan visited the bus terminal on the outskirts of the capital, Abuja, several hours after the bomb went off during Monday morning rush hour. The story now from Heather Murdoch in Abuja.
Shortly before 7 a.m. Monday morning, taxi driver Joseph Suleiman was driving into the city for work. He was about a half a kilometer from Nyanya Motor Park when the bomb exploded.
We were inside the car. We heard the bomb blast. And my car was shaking. Everybody, we were totally confused.
They were confused, he says, because there hasn't been an attack in the Nigerian capital in 2 years, when Boko Haram blew up a prominent media house, killing several people. In 2011, more than 60 people were killed in other attacks that targeted the local UN headquarters and a church. Suleiman says he saw scores of badly injured people as he passed the bus depot.
People told us that it was the Boko Haram that put the bomb inside the Erufai car that exploded, that killed many lives. But actually, it is only God that knows the truth.
Some officials say despite nearly a year of emergency rule in three northeastern Nigerian states, the Boko Haram insurgency is growing. This is Member of Parliament Herman Hembe.
We've allocated huge sums for particularly security in this country, and I don't see any improvements. It's just been getting worse.
Boko Haram has been blamed for thousands of deaths since the insurgency began in 2009. Amnesty International says 1,500 people have been killed in attacks this year alone, and about a half a million people have fled their homes. Boko Haram says it wants to enforce its harsh version of Islamic law and destroy the government, but many analysts blame the unrest partially on extreme poverty, saying unemployment drives young men to fight for small sums of money. However, Pastor Ayo Oritsejifor, the president of the Christian Association of Nigeria, says the insurgency is a result of religious extremism.
It's about ideology, it's not poverty. It's not marginalization. Yes, it is true that when you deal with poverty, you may reduce the number of recruits, people that they can recruit.
Attacking the ideology through education and the religious leadership in Nigeria's mostly Muslim northern states is the only way to end the insurgency, he says. The Nigerian military maintains that it has beaten back Boko Haram and reclaimed many areas formerly held by insurgents. The military says a jailbreak last month where hundreds of fleeing detainees were killed was an attempt by Boko Haram to replenish its depleted ranks. Boko Haram claimed responsibility for the jailbreak and threatened more violence. The group has not claimed responsibility for this latest attack, but typically Boko Haram communicates with the public through video messages, which can take days or weeks to release. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
In North Central, Central African Republic, Doctors Without Borders says several thousand civilians have fled into the bush following fighting between anti-Balaka militia and African Union peacekeepers. VOA's Ann Look has more from our West Africa Bureau.
Doctors Without Borders says 7,000 civilians fled the northern town of Bogila after fighting broke out there late Friday and continued into Saturday. The aid agency, known by its French acronym MSF, says AU peacekeepers were escorting a convoy of 540 Muslims from Bosengoa to Chad. The convoy had just passed through Bogila when MSF says it appears it was attacked by anti-Balaka militia. The militia have been targeting Muslim civilians since intercommunal violence broke out in December and the mostly Muslim Seleka rebel coalition pulled back to the north. MSF says it treated at least three wounded at its hospitals in Bogila and nearby Paoa, but fears there may be more. Medical staff could not access the combat zone. MSF spokesman in the CAR, Mathieu Fortoul, says they are worried that civilians in the convoy were also hit. He says the convoy was headed to the refugee camp in Gore, Chad, so they are working with their teams there to evaluate the situation. MSF says Bogila is in a particularly unstable part of the country, and bouts of fighting between armed groups there regularly force civilians into the bush. Fortoul says this raises a number of risks, in particular poor sanitation conditions. He says the rainy season is underway, when malaria cases typically spike. He says displaced people are very exposed to the disease, which is the number one cause of death in the country. The 540 Muslims fleeing Bosengoa were the last Muslims in that town. They were being evacuated after months of living under constant threat from the anti-Balaka. The Chadi and Miska troops escorting them were also on their way out of the country. During the past week, Chad has pulled its peacekeepers from northern towns like Buka and Kagabandaro. Earlier this month, Chad said it would be withdrawing from the AU peacekeeping force after what it said was excessive criticism. Miska troops from Gabon and Congo have begun taking their place in some of those towns. Ann Look, VOA News, Dakar.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Navi Pillay condemns what she says is the widespread and systematic use of torture in detention facilities in Syria. A report just issued by her office finds detainees are routinely tortured by the Assad government and by some armed opposition groups. Lisa Schlein reports now from the High Commissioner's office in Geneva.
A UN report describes conditions of detention in some Syrian government-run facilities as absolutely horrific, with dozens of people crammed into a tiny cell, forced to use one hole as a toilet. UN investigators say some detainees are subjected to physical, mental, and sexual torture, which often leaves the victims permanently scarred. They say some have died. The report finds men, women, and children are picked up from the street, their homes, and workplaces. Some are arrested at Syrian government checkpoints. It says many are activists, including students, lawyers, medical personnel, and humanitarian workers. A UN Human Rights Commissioner spokeswoman, Ravina Shamdasani, tells VOA her office has received extremely disturbing reports of the type of torture meted out to detainees.
We have reports of this 130-year-old university student describing how he was beaten, how his beard was pulled out in clumps, his feet were burned, his toenails were torn off with pliers at an Air Force intelligence facility. We have a woman who told how she was first berated and insulted, then beaten, and then raped. Another man also spoke about sexual violence against him.
UN investigators say torture by armed opposition groups appears to be on the rise since 2013, particularly in Al-Raqqa in northern Syria. But they say torture is not committed by all armed groups, and when it occurs, it is sporadic and not systematic, as is the case with the government. The report describes torture committed by two Al-Qaeda-linked rebel groups, the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, and the Al-Nusra Front. Testimony from victims indicate those most at risk of being detained and tortured by some rebel groups are activists trying to document human rights violations and people believed to be pro-government or affiliated with a rival opposition group. Shamdasani says it is difficult to know how many people are being detained or how many have been tortured to death because UN human rights monitors are unable to enter Syria. She says the UN investigators interviewed 38 people who had been tortured and witnessed others being tortured. She says it is difficult to document the number of people who have died in custody because the Syrian government uses various ploys to keep this information hidden.
There is a very good attempt at cover-up. Sometimes families are requested to go to the hospital to pick up their relative's body, and then the corpses are received in closed coffins, which prevent the family from either seeing the body or verifying the cause of the death. In other instances, families are simply given the identity documents of their loved ones and don't actually see the body. And occasionally they're asked to sign papers saying that their loved ones were killed by armed opposition groups and to immediately and discreetly bury their bodies.
UN Rights Chief Navi Pillay says international law prohibits the use of torture at all times and under all circumstances. She says in armed conflict, torture constitutes a war crime. She adds, when torture is used in a systematic or widespread manner, as appears to be the case in Syria, then it also amounts to a crime against humanity. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English. Prosecutors say they have enough evidence to pursue charges in the shooting spree that killed three people at a Jewish community center and retirement complex near the U.S. city of Kansas City, Kansas. John Douglas is the police chief in the town of Overland Park, where the shootings happened.
We have unquestionably determined through the work of local and federal law enforcement agencies that this was a hate crime.
Frazier Glenn Cross is a known white supremacist and has not been formally charged in the slaying so far, but officials said more information about charges are expected later today. Police say Cross fatally shot two people on Sunday afternoon in the parking lot behind the Jewish Community Center of Greater Kansas City, then drove to a retirement community where he shot a third person. Mindy Lozen's father and son, Reet, were among those killed.
I prayed that Reet would survive. I prayed and prayed and prayed that he would survive. But I've later found out why he didn't. I know that they both died from head trauma. And I feel confident from what I heard that they didn't feel anything.
Cross, a former Ku Klux Klan leader who was once the subject of a nationwide manhunt, was jailed on a preliminary charge of first-degree murder. Mark Poddock of the Southern Poverty Law Center says Cross is much more than a Klan member.
Fundamentally, he was a neo-Nazi, meaning that for him, as he said pretty recently, Jews were 1,000 times worse than black people, brown people, gay people, the whole laundry list.
And at the White House on Monday during a prayer breakfast, President Obama spoke about the shootings in Overland Park.
Nobody should have to worry about their security when gathering with their fellow believers. No one should ever have to fear for their safety when they go to pray.
All three of the shooting victims were Christians. The world must switch from fossil fuels to cleaner energy sources to control the effects of climate change, according to a new UN report. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released the report following a meeting of scientists and government representatives in Berlin. The comprehensive review follows two recent IPCC reports that detail the certainty of climate change, its impacts, and in its most recent release, what to do about it. More now from VOA's Roseanne Scurbel.
The solution to the climate problem could start with this, a massive solar project in California's Mojave Desert. It began operation in February and will provide enough power for 140,000 homes, says NRG Energy President David Crane.
Our generation of leadership can get the ball rolling in fighting against climate change so that the next generation, the people who are in their 20s and 30s today, can finish the job. Then we will have done the best that we can do to get this going.
That kind of action must be taken on a global scale, says Rajendra Pachauri, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change chairman.
So there is, if we really want to bring about a limitation of temperature increase to no more than 2 degrees Celsius, then this is the message that comes out very clearly from this report.
The report says global greenhouse gas emissions must be cut by 40 to 70% by mid-century to avoid devastating effects from severe weather in a warmer world. But solutions are within reach, says Nathaniel Cohane, who leads international efforts to address climate change for the Environmental Defense Fund. He spoke via Skype.
There are a handful of things around energy efficiency, renewable energy, reducing deforestation, and a handful of things that the world could do, and we could help turn the corner by 2020 and get on track to reduce emissions enough to keep the climate safe.
Renewable energy sources like solar, wind, and hydropower account for 8.5% of the world energy output and 20% if nuclear is added to the mix. However, Cohane says a gulf exists between international efforts and what needs to be done to make the switch from fossil fuels to cleaner energy.
When you look at the stats and the data in the report, it shows, for example, that coal has been growing faster than other sources. So we need to reverse that trend, and we do need to rapidly ramp up the sources of renewable power, the share of renewable power.
The report finds that the longer the delay in controlling emissions, the greater the cost to public health and the environment. Cohane says voters must tell their governments that climate change matters.
We need to get on top of it. But the optimism comes from knowing that if we do get that political will and if we can push in that direction, that we have the technologies to get started on this problem. We just need everybody to pitch in.
The report says a window of opportunity remains for the world community to act. UN negotiators are working on a new international agreement to curb global emissions to replace the Kyoto Protocol on climate change, which expired in 2012. Roseanne Scurbel, VOA News, Washington.
Two newspapers that revealed U.S. government secrets about spying by the National Security Agency, The Washington Post and Britain's The Guardian, will share this year's Pulitzer Prize for public service. Their stories, based on thousands of secret documents handed over by National Security Agency leaker Edward Snowden, touched off a furious debate in U.S. over piracy, a privacy that is, versus security, and led by President Obama to impose limits on surveillance. The Pulitzers are best known in the most prestigious awards for arts and journalism in the U.S. Pulitzer Prize for Breaking News was awarded to the Boston Globe for its coverage of the Boston Marathon bombings and the manhunt that followed. The New York Times won two Pulitzers in photography, including documenting of the terrorist attack at the Westgate Mall in Kenya. And the prize for international reporting was awarded to Reuters news agency for its stories on the violent persecution of the Rohingya, a Muslim minority and Muslim in Burma, also known as Myanmar. Well, the most decorated Olympic athlete of all times, Michael Phelps, is coming out of retirement. Phelps, who left the sport after taking 6 medals at the 2012 London Olympics, will make his competitive comeback. It'll happen next week at a swim meet in the U.S. state of Arizona. Phelps has won 22 Olympic medals, including 18 gold, could be taking the first step, they say, toward possibly swimming at the 2016 Rio Olympics. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us. A reminder, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay tuned. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zarat Abu Zaid, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On April 15, 1452, artist, architect, and scientist Leonardo da Vinci was born in the Florentine city of Vinci. Best known for his paintings of The Last Supper and the Mona Lisa, da Vinci's thirst for knowledge also resulted in a vast array of innovative designs and inventions. On this day in 1755, the comprehensive A Dictionary of the English Language was published. Contracted to write a dictionary by a group of London booksellers, Samuel Johnson took 9 years to complete the task. The scope and structure became a template for dictionaries that followed. In 1865, Abraham Lincoln died after being shot the previous evening by John Wilkes Booth. In 1892, the General Electric Company was formed. GE became one of the world's largest corporations. In 1912, the RMS cruise liner Titanic sank in the North Atlantic on its maiden voyage from England to New York. More than 1,500 passengers and crew died in one of history's most notorious maritime disasters. In 1955, entrepreneur Ray Kroc opened his first McDonald's restaurant in Des Plaines, Illinois. Originally a business started by California brothers Dick and Mac McDonald, Kroc bought all the rights and expanded the McDonald's concept to become one of the world's leading fast food restaurants. In 1986, President Ronald Reagan ordered U.S. warplanes to attack targets in Libya. The attack was in retaliation for the bombing of a West Berlin discotheque blamed on Libyan-backed terrorists. In 2013, two bombs exploded near the finish line at the Boston Marathon in Boston, Massachusetts, killing three people and wounding 264. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Leaders from four Southeast Asian nations have agreed to strengthen regional cooperation in developing and protecting the water resources on the Mekong River Basin. Meeting in Ho Chi Minh City April 2nd through 5th, the premiers of Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and the special envoy of Thailand approved a declaration recommitting their nations to the 1995 Mekong Agreement that created a framework to build consensus among Mekong Basin nations on development and other issues. The lower Mekong River runs from China through the four Southeast Asian nations to the sea. Nearly 70 million people in the basin rely heavily on the river for their livelihoods, and those involved in irrigated agriculture and fishing make up 85% of the workforce there. Because problems at any point could affect millions of people downstream, nations along the river organized in 1994 to form the Mekong River Commission to work cooperatively to address them. At the Commission's second summit in Ho Chi Minh City last week, leaders identified ensuring water, energy, and food security in the context of climate change as priorities they will focus on in the months to come. The United States congratulates the Commission and its member nations for nearly two decades of achievement. Through the MRC, regional governments have improved the lives of millions of people through sustainable economic development and regional cooperation. That said, the challenges facing the Commission and the River Basin nations are greater than ever before. Increasing demands on the Mekong's resources, rapid development, and the effects of climate change are putting greater pressure on the river, threatening a unique environment and the livelihoods of millions. Responding to these challenges will require greater scientific and technical capacity, increased investment, and still more regional cooperation. Through programs such as the Lower Mekong Initiative and Connect Mekong, the United States is committed to supporting the efforts of the Mekong River Basin nations to improve regional cooperation and management of the river's resources, providing a sustainable future for all who depend on the waters of the Mekong.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.